This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've walked your snow-capped mountains.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is October 18th, 2020, and this is a bonus episode on the Liberal and Green platforms.
I'm Scott Delonnebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we dig into the platforms of the BC Liberals and BC Greens, which dropped in the last week, and we just did not have time to cover with all of the other politics that have been happening. Thanks to the 105 people who contribute every month. Thanks especially to our newest patron, William, and to Mercedes, who upped their pledge. All that extra support has helped us to be able to bring you an extra bonus pod, and you can join them at patreon.com/politicoast. And just a quick reminder to check out BC Today for daily coverage of the BC politics. Sign up for a free trial at politicstoday.news. Let's get into it. We have two platforms to talk about, but before we even get into that, I think it's worth mentioning that you can listen to our analysis with Stuart Prest of the NDP platform in episode 210. And I think the first question to ask is, or first thing to look at, is the timing of these platforms coming out. The Liberals released their platform on the day of the debate and the Greens the day after, neither of which strike me as opportune.
Particularly the Liberal one. Like, what were they even thinking putting that out the morning of the debate? At best, you get, what, 6 hours of media coverage when everyone's at work, and before you get into the debate, which is going to completely swamp everything else. Was anyone actually talking about the Liberal platform at all past like 5:30 on the day they released it?
And it came right after a long weekend. Like, maybe they didn't have it done in time. That's the only reason I can think. And they wanted to have it out before the debate, so they felt like they could debate it. That was one thing that was frustrating about the Greens, is they went into the debate without saying fully what they do. And there's no requirement that you do it, but it just feels more honest, forthcoming to be like, we've put out our offer, now we will debate it against the other parties. And so a little bit frustrating on both there. Maybe, like I said, maybe both of the parties were struggling to pull a platform together because it was a snap election call that was not forewarned at all.
They definitely do seem less thorough than some of the 2017 platforms. It was particularly noticeable when reading through the Green one, but I think the same applies for the Liberals too. It's just clearly a snap election platform and not a fully thought out, we've been working on this for months type of platform.
Let's get into the Liberal platform then. Restore confidence, rebuild BC. Scott, you dug through this fairly thoroughly. What's jumped out at you?
So, before I get into that, I just want to first start with the title. I touched on this briefly in episode 211, the one we just dropped earlier this week, which is the title. Why did they choose Restore Confidence, Rebuild BC? The implication of that name is that British Columbians are lacking in confidence in the current situation, which from every poll I've seen just isn't the case. It's a fine message to try and run on if you're an opposition party, but it seems to me there's a prerequisite that you have to make the case to British Columbians that there is a reason to lack confidence, which although they've tried, they actually haven't been successful at over the past several years, which makes the choice to emphasize restoring confidence odd.
The rebuild BC part at least seems apt. Maybe things aren't crumbled, but you need to rebuild the economy.
Yeah, the second part I think is a lot more solid than the first. But let's jump into it. So they've broken the way the platform structured is there's a bunch of headline promises right at the start, followed by a letter from Andrew Wilkinson, then a list of everything they want to do in their first 60 days, and then a section by section thing about all the various policy areas they're going to be addressing. So let's jump into kind of the headline promises. A bunch of these have already been announced. There was the promise to eliminate PST for 1 year. then set it at 3% until the economy recovers. We talked about this a lot, I think episode, was it 210? So I don't think we really need to go on it too much here, but it's, you know, front and center. It's the first promise in the platform. It's clearly a core part of what they're running on.
Yeah, I wasn't I wasn't a hugest fan of it then. It's still, it's a more bold pitch, but
yeah, and this is
it's a blunt tool.
Yeah, this incarnation of the Liberals haven't been particularly bold, so in that sense, it's nice to see. But yeah, like I said at the time, I don't hate it, but it's not necessarily the policy I would have chosen either. The other big tax items in their headline promises are to eliminate the small business tax. Now, I believe it's currently, I think, 2% of small business profits. So it's, you know, not a case where I can see it being a massive impediment to small businesses, particularly as any small business struggling enough to the point where they aren't turning a profit, aren't paying the tax anyway. But it's, I guess, a bone to throw. And politicians love to talk about how much they support small businesses.
Yeah.
And the other item is they want to have an independent tax fairness commission, which honestly actually seems like a pretty decent idea. Tax codes are one of those things that every budget, they always get like needled around a bit and a boutique tax credit here or there. It's probably a good idea to just, as a periodic thing the government does, do a big commission on them and figure out what needs to be taken out, simplified, reformed. So yeah, solid point there, I think, for them.
Yeah, the risk with it is that it becomes politicized. The argument is that this will take the politics out of it, but I think we've seen with Jason Kenney's UCP in Alberta that the terms of reference can define it very clearly which way these kind of commissions are and how truly independent they are. I'm not entirely sold that tax policy should be independent of government. Like, the point of electing government is to set a policy, and so you can't pretend that tax policy is just this like apolitical thing. Ultimately, it's the most political thing a government can do. Ultimately, yes, clean up the tax code. There's always improvements that can be made. They do frame it very heavily, though, around reviewing the, I think they say, 23 taxes the NDP have implemented or increased.
That's pretty standard opposition framing. So the other big items are $10 a day child care for low-income British Columbians, which we'll find out later on is defined as pretty much anyone with a household income below $65,000. And that scales upwards up till household income hits $125,000, where child care can be up to $30 a day in that case. That's going to be paired with 10,000 new child care spaces. On the long-term care side of things, they're looking at $1 billion over 5 years for new long-term care facilities, private rooms for all who want it in long-term care homes. I'd be curious to see the math on that one, because from what I understand, there's very few private homes and or private units in a lot of the long-term care homes, which would make, I think, a challenge to build up the entire thing for a couple hundred million a year.
I think this is a similar end goal to what the NDP is trying to do. The Liberals are trying to do it in a slightly different way, but both are trying to eliminate shared accommodations for long-term care, which I think is an admirable goal.
Also in there is a $7,000 a year tax credit for seniors in home care. So support seniors living at home who need support and care. Next up is the promise to end the ICBC monopoly, which they've been agitating at for several years now. Completely unsurprising to see it in this platform. They announced a couple weeks back too.
Yeah, I think we talked about it a little bit.
Yes. Additionally, they want to reduce rates for young drivers.
They talked about a two-year credit, I think, for drivers.
Yeah, so basically anyone getting their driver's license would start at year two of driving under the ICBC system, and then I guess stay that way for the first 2 years, and then goes to normal after that. And then the final couple of headline items are increased public safety funding by $58 million, increase addiction and recovery programs, work to decrease crime and issue and address issues of systemic racism in society, and spend $8 billion in additional infrastructure spending over the next 3 years for a total of $30.9 billion.
So they've clearly identified like what the key issues people have at front of mind are, right? There's COVID relief and how do we get the economy going? There's childcare and long-term care, where they've come around to like NDP light versions or like modifications where it's slightly more affordable by either means testing or just spending less or using tax credits. And ICBC is still an issue, and the overdose epidemic, and their focus there is unsurprisingly on public safety and also treatment programs. Oh, and build stuff, spend a lot of money on building stuff. And some of these we've, like you said, we've talked about a few times, but they also have a ambitious first 60 days plan. So what was the highlight in there?
Yeah. So before we get into that, I'm just going to briefly note. So the items we just talked about are the ones that are clearly what they want to run on, make the center point of their campaign, the thing they front load in the document before they even get to the introduction by the leader in there. And what's interesting is what isn't in there, notably housing affordability. Like last election, that was such a dominant issue throughout the whole thing. And yet, the situation hasn't really changed that much. Housing is still pretty much unaffordable for anyone living in the more populated parts of the province, and even some of the less populated parts. And yet, it doesn't even get a mention in here. You'd think that it would be at least slightly more pressing an issue than, say, new drivers' insurance rates.
I feel like all of the parties have been dodging questions on housing, though. So this isn't unique to the Liberals.
It's not unique to the Liberals.
We will get to the promises they make on housing.
Yeah. I just wanted to flag that that's an interesting change in the politics of the province, despite the fact that the underlying situation hasn't actually changed. But yeah, let's jump into the first 60 days. So a lot of it is starting to implement the promises we talked about before. So they want to bring in their economic response plan to address, well, the issues with the economy. That's going to include the PST cut as well as a comprehensive review of regulatory processes, appointing a new tax fairness commission. Additionally, they want to bring in new fixed election date legislation, and most notably, as that part of that is reduce the premier's ability to call an early election, which I don't know how anyone who even watched a bit of what was going on in the UK as they were trying to deal with Brexit in a parliament that there was no clear majority for anything thinks it's a good idea to neuter the ability of the First Minister to call an election.
So they say specifically banning early elections during provincial emergencies. Now, it's not clear how long this emergency will be. This would essentially stick us in a permanent minority situation. This is the kind of the promise, though, that matches the kind of things Trudeau ran on in 2015. Like, I won't do omnibus bills and I won't abuse proroguing. And yeah, they're appealing to people's frustration.
Yeah, every opposition party includes in their platform a bunch of points about the various procedural abuses the last government did and how they're going to swear up and down to change the system to prevent that in the future.
Only then they eventually discover different procedural abuses to use, or the same ones.
Discover how useful those procedural abuses are, just forget they ever promised to get rid of them. But in addition to those items, they're going to form an all-party pandemic response committee, launch a province-wide framework for hybrid and online learning, as well as an independent review of the COVID-19 response in long-term care.
Yeah, there's a few other promises in there, but none are too surprising. And it's nice to see a here's what we'll do soon, because if you're going to form government, you should, especially a change of government, you should promise to do something with that. And given we're having an election in the fall, it wouldn't be unreasonable to see a new government not reconvene the legislature until February or later.
Yeah, that is.
But I would like to see things pass quickly.
The one thing I'm a little, I'm not sure if hesitant is the right word, but dislike about it slightly is it feels like yet another example of creeping Americanization of our politics, where the first 100 days is this, you know, super important thing for presidents and how they, if it's never really been like a huge deal in Canadian politics, yet this framing feels very reminiscent of that.
There's a lot of specifics in this platform, and rather than go through line by line, we'll definitely throw a link to the PDF document itself in the show notes and people can turn to that. But let's go through some of the highlights you pulled out in the sections as they appear in order. So right off the top is childcare. So we mentioned that's one of their signature promises, a means-tested $10 a day system. What do you think?
So they want to means test it with kind of a couple different income cutoffs. $10 a day for anyone making, any household making up to $65,000. And then after that, they say it as a $20 or $30 a day daycare based on household income up to $125,000. I'd heard elsewhere that it was more of a sliding scale thing they were thinking of in that range, but the platform document itself isn't super clear on it. Basically, yeah, you have a couple different daycare rates you could be in dependent on household income. It seems fine. It's going to be one of those technical things where it's really going to depend on how efficient they are going to be at administering the thing as to whether the cost savings and means testing are really going to be there or not.
Yeah, it definitely shows, I think, how much the $10 a day campaigners are winning the argument, such that the NDPs on that platform, the Greens, as we'll get to, go further. And we've talked about their pitch in the past. And now even the Liberals are like, all right, we need to get to $10 a day, but we'll do it in our way, which is to means test it and have a mix of nonprofit and market-based, where I think the other two parties are really focused on nonprofit options and especially bringing it within the Ministry of Education. The BC Liberals would not bring it in the Ministry of Education like the others and would rather have a full Ministry of Childcare instead of a Minister of State who would oversee all of this.
Yeah, they'd bump up a Minister of State to a full ministry.
I don't have a strong
opinion on whether or not that's going to be worthwhile or not.
I can see the value of putting it in education, since a lot of the focus in the other parties are on early childhood educators and making sure, especially once you're hitting preschool age, that it's not just babysitting, essentially state-sponsored babysitting, but opportunities to help children develop, because that can be a real equalizer and a real way to fight inequality through education.
Yeah, but overall, I think it's definitely fair to say that there's a kind of all-party consensus on the need for childcare in BC. So don't actually expect it's going to be that contentious going forward, wherever the outcome of the election ends up being. But let's jump onto the next section, which is about children and students, not just childcare. So they want to double the number of midwives graduating every year, increase the affordability and availability of IVF, in vitro fertilization services, as well as build new schools throughout the province. And they have a bunch of points in there that I don't think we really have time to go into about improving schools in a bunch of other ways.
Yeah, and these are all a little bit vague. There's nothing specific about we'll put this much money here or we'll do that. It's more just they'll be properly equipped and we'll build what we need.
Yeah,
so it's not bad, but it leaves more that if you're voting on education issues, you might feel a bit neglected by this.
Yeah, and the vagueness is something that I think is heard in them here, because there isn't much to really rally around on here if you are an education voter. And it seems to like, I think part of the lack of broader focus or coherent ideas by the Liberal campaign, it's never really done a great job campaign or anything. And if like a big part of this, which you mentioned earlier, is the $8 billion in additional infrastructure spending. And some of that does include schools, hence this last point here about building schools throughout the province. It's one thing to say, yeah, we're going to build a bunch of schools. But if you're trying to win votes, you know, why isn't, say, an Olympic Village school called out by name in this platform? The NDP announced their support for, that they were going to build one during this past week. You know, why aren't, that's a riding the Liberals hold right now and are trying to hold on to. Why weren't they first out the gate promising that?
I think the same vagueness goes into the next section on adult learners, which is a post-secondary education component, as far as I can tell. Again, it's about training more people, building more trades programs, for example.
Yeah, the one that I did was they want to bring in a requirements based off the UK's model, where that would require basically every program being offered to disclose what the complete cost of the program is, the rates of graduation and employment for people who go through the program. Yeah, honestly, seems like a good idea. And it's one of those things you're actually a little surprised isn't already required to be disclosed.
The only reason I bristle at that is when I see UK Office for Standards and Education. I just know that's short for the acronym for that is Ofsted, and they're the people who send inspectors into schools to watch teachers teach for 10 minutes and then give the teacher a grade that determines their pay and creates a lot of anxiety and a very toxic work environment for the UK education system. So I'm not a hugest fan of that office, but this specific disclosure requirement seems reasonable.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, the next session they have is seniors. So we already mentioned the long-term care home stuff, as well as the tax credit for seniors. In here, they add a few more details that it would basically be $7,000 a year tax credit for seniors spending up to $20,000 on housekeeping, home repair, and supportive care.
The big problem with a tax credit is you need to be making the money for that to really help you or have a taxable pension. I'm not clear how much this helps seniors living in poverty or near the poverty line versus helping wealthier ones who have housekeepers and can pay supportive care.
I think it's going to really depend on whether it's a refundable or non-refundable tax credit, which it just does not say in here. So I mean, if it's a refundable tax credit, it would, I suppose, in theory, act almost like a UBI type situation where any senior would get paid a bit on there. But once again, the vagueness of the Liberal platform is confounding our analysis a bit. And the other couple items I pulled out of there of interest is they want to increase the supply of fully accessible units in new multi-unit residential buildings. So this would be changes to the BC Building Code to advance that policy, as well as they want a free central registry for advanced care plans for families and seniors.
That would actually be super helpful.
Yeah, that last one seems like one of those like helpful, why not, tweak to the system that not going to cost a lot, but has a lot of benefits for the people accessing it. On healthcare, the Liberals want free influenza vaccines. They want to establish more primary care networks and community health centers, as well as expand opportunities for international graduates to work as healthcare professionals in BC and increase online booking and medical appointments. All good things.
None of this really strikes me as different than the other parties. Like the primary care network stuff is in the BC Green platform. It's stuff that's already been put underway by the BC NDP government. And so it's all kind of pointing in the same direction. And like healthcare, education, these things that they put on the top of their platform are all areas that are NDP strengths generally. Like to the naive voter, they would think more towards the left parties than towards the BC Liberals. And so there's nothing that quite stands out in here as, oh, here's at least, I guess what it looks at is we're not going to cut anything. We're going to keep going in roughly the same direction. Maybe we won't be as ambitious, but things won't go bad.
Yeah, there's very little in here that really sets the Liberals apart on a lot of these platform areas. Bundled in with healthcare, and also along those same lines of thinking you were talking about just now, is on mental health and addictions, where they want to increase addiction and addiction treatment and recovery programs, recognize addiction as a mental health problem, increase mental health supports in schools. All of those pretty much could be taken from any of the platform's agenda. The one line that did really stand out to me was they want to end funding discrimination that continues to disqualify abstinence-based treatment programs.
I didn't know they were disqualified in BC. I think there are quite a few 12-step programs that get provincial funding. Maybe yeah, there's
My understanding is the abstinence-based programs generally don't have a great track record of success.
Yeah, some of the newer evidence is a bit more mixed, but it depends on how you define the outcomes. The best I've seen is that harm reduction is what we need, what the advocates are calling for, are starting with there. In terms of treatment programs, you can't force people into something and expect it to work. So having a variety is reasonable, I think. I don't know what is motivating this, but it seems something that, because a lot of the abstinence-based programs tend to be faith-based, and that just gets my bristles up. So
I think that probably has a lot to do with it. It's a nod to the more religious and socially conservative elements of the party. On public safety, we already touched on the $58 million additional funding, but part of what that's going to go for is hiring 200 additional police officers, 40 additional crown prosecutors, reducing backlogs in court, more integrated mobile crisis response teams for mental health-related emergency calls, as well as tracking down on gangs, the illegal transport of handguns, including seizure of vehicles, which I don't think either of us are really fans of asset forfeiture in a lot of cases.
No.
Especially since it tends to be done without nearly the level oversight of protections that criminal defendants otherwise get. In addition to that, there's the referendum they want to have on the Surrey Police Force changes. We talked about that in episode 2, Tanzel. Refer you back to that conversation, because I think we're running a little low on time.
There's a suite of stuff related to the defund the police calls, which relates more from their point of view in terms of better training for police, essentially. They're actually saying we should fund police more, but just make sure they have training so they'll be less racist.
Which is actually, I think, not a bad policy approach overall, because you want a disciplined and well-trained police, since we're not going to be abolishing the police. You want them to be the highest quality police they can be, and that's going to require more training, and training costs money. So it makes sense to me on that. But additionally, they want to protect British Columbians' rights to access public road, bridge, and railroad from unlawful blockades. Not really a surprise. At the start of the year, the blockades were a major issue of contention. Entirely unsurprised to see this in here.
This kind of relates as well, I think, to one that's under the equality section that we skip by for time, but where they want to ban foreign money and influence in BC politics, which is
that one the seems only thing much I can... more, they,
it's very vague.
Yeah.
But I think it's targeted at the like Vivian Krause, the Tides Foundation stuff.
Yeah, I think that was too. I mean, this prevent blockade stuff actually makes, I think, is more justifiable, at least not anywhere nearly as crazy as the Tides stuff that gets thrown around. But speaking of things that kind of go into the worn places that right-wing politics have often gone in this province. They want to ban photo radar, which
all feels like eight uses of photo radar we have now.
Real throwback to like the 2001 campaign on that one. But hey, when you're behind, might as well try and play the greatest hits.
Let's get into the home buy or the let's get into the housing section.
Yeah,
since there's some good meat there.
Yeah, this was one of the more interesting sections. And I'm not just saying that because housing policy is one of my areas of interest. There's actually a surprising amount of change in this one. This is probably actually the section that would be the most reform oriented of the various sections, I think. A lot of the other ones, like we're going to more or less stay the course, make some tweaks here and there. Where this one actually proposes some fairly significant changes. So they start off talking about wanting to incentivize funds for municipalities to add new housing supply. I'm not really sold on that because I think it's a case where you need if the province is getting involved, you need both a carrot and a stick to get municipalities to bringing pro-housing policies. And this platform does seem to lean a lot more towards the carrot than the stick, but it's a campaign, so I get why they want to do that. In addition to that, they want to work with municipalities to change tax and permitting rules to encourage more rental and market housing. That one, I think, is really going to depend on how much is directed from the province versus implemented at the city level. But also, they want to create a new property tax structure to incentivize affordable housing. I could see this being a situation where, in addition to the, I think, currently six categories of properties that get assessed through BC assessments, they add one for like nonprofit housing that has a very low rate or something like that. But I think the thing that actually has perhaps the biggest potential, makes structurally quite a bit of difference, is that they want to require that zoning bylaws be updated within 1 year of official community plans, as well as waive the requirement for hearings for projects that comply with the community plans, which doesn't sound like much, but would actually be huge. There's like so many buildings in Vancouver that are being proposed have to go through this like long public hearing process because the community plan requires a developer-initiated rezoning to actually build anything, which requires a public hearing. And just not having it, if it complies with the public plan, you can just go right to your development permits would actually...
It's like the point of the plan, you would think.
Yeah, no, it's... Once you actually get into the weeds of how these sorts of plans get implemented, it's nuts and infuriating in a lot of ways how the city's worked with it. So actually putting these requirements in that plans have to actually be plans that are binding would be quite huge in terms of reducing a lot of the structural barriers to new housing. And keep in mind, these sorts of requirements for public hearings almost always also apply to nonprofit and non-market housing and social housing. So this would help a lot of like affordable housing get built as well, not just market rate housing. So in addition to that, they want to support inclusionary zoning and rental-only zoning. Both fine. I'm not entirely sold on either one of them as like major affordability of mechanisms, but I don't think they're like actively harmful either. So fine. They want to bring in split assessments, both in general as well as having rental properties be assessed based on current use, not future use, which would take a bunch of the redevelopment pressures off older rental properties, as well as they want to use provincial and municipal land for affordable housing, build more housing to get homeless British Columbians into a home, improve the approvals process, the accessible units thing we mentioned up above. And finally, they want to get rid of the NDP's speculation tax and replace it with a condo flipping tax.
The Liberals have not liked the speculation tax from day one, largely because a big chunk of it affects the wealthiest people who own multiple properties, and so they would rather target different things. I think the speculation tax has been a reasonable tool. I am not opposed to a condo flipping tax as well.
Yeah, flipping tats seems reasonable. The speculation tats, I think it helped on the margin a bit. I think the Liberals' opposition to it is politically dumb because it scores something like 71% approval when you poll on it. Everyone but like the few people hit with it seem to like it, so I can keep it.
Oh, and the Liberals also want to charge non-residents higher property taxes to prevent foreign investing inflation.
Kind of getting the same thing the speculation tax does through a slightly different route.
Some good stuff in there. Really focused on supply side, but we definitely need a lot more built.
Yeah.
No clear targets for the number of houses built, but the NDP made a promise of 114,000, and it's hard to say how far along they are. The Liberals here claim that they haven't even opened 3,000. That doesn't account for all the shovels in the ground, and that plan was out of over 10 years. It's really hard and slow to build housing, even if you implemented all these changes.
Yeah, although a lot of these changes would cut those timelines down by a year or two, which would be a big benefit. But yeah, no hard numbers associated with this, but a lot of actually quite useful structural changes they'd be proposing here. So it's a reasonably solid housing platform for a provincial level government. It's not exactly what I'd have in my dream housing policy platform, but solid nonetheless. So the last major section I want to touch on here is infrastructure. So we talked about the $8 billion in additional infrastructure. That's going to add to the existing infrastructure spending that's already on the federal, that's already on the provincial books to bring it up to $30.9 billion total. A bunch of that goes right into replacing the George Massey Tunnel with a 10-lane bridge. But they also want to continue expanding TransLink into areas of population growth, such as south of the Fraser Valley and North Vancouver. Province-wide, they want to increase transit hours, review the ferry schedule with the goal of hourly sailings on high-frequency routes, as well as establish a premier's office in northern BC in Prince George.
I think they promised that in 2017. It sounds very familiar. I don't know if it's a good idea. I don't know how useful it would be, especially during the pandemic, but maybe after. It's just a way to at least signal that you care about the North.
Yes.
The rest of the infrastructure build out actually sounds a lot like the NDP's. The TransLink stuff is almost identical. Expanding Highway 1 is identical. Reviewing ferry schedules is very similar. Like the numbers of spending, the only big difference is that bridge that the NDP canceled, and they are really gung-ho on.
Yeah, and we talked about this a bit earlier, but I feel the big problem here, you can argue whether or not a 10-lane bridge is overkill, which I think there's pretty good argument for, is that on the politics side of it, it's great that you want to spend a bunch of money on infrastructure. They said they're not going to worry about the deficit until we're past COVID, at which point they're going to try and bring it into balance. But they basically have a pretty free hand fiscally right now, both with where interest rates are and what they are willing to commit to and signal on this. So I guess my big question here is, this seems not particularly bold when half the title is Rebuild BC. There's anywhere nearly enough building in here. Like, why aren't they going for, say, $20 billion over 5 years, and then spend the campaign going up and down the province, promising every riding that they could potentially win a piece of that pie with something that's, you know, needed in the riding would be very popular. This, the start of a platform and campaign idea, but not really fleshed out to the point of being the thing they should be running on if they actually want to win this.
Not wrong. There's a number of other elements they talk about in the platform that are very specific. Parks, farming, they have a lot of stuff like expanding the Trespass Act to get those PETA activists and stuff like that.
Well, they don't say it is the PETA activists.
I had to look up what their previous comments on this Trespass Act because I was curious. And Lori Thronis had mentioned the PETA people.
On the park thing, they do want to improve the online booking thing, which I think will be something that quite a few people we'll be happy to see.
The one thing that I'm really disappointed not to see more on was their climate change section. They don't want to turn us back on Clean BC, but they don't really imagine going much further on it. And like some building code changes, stuff like that.
The vagueness, again, is something that is annoying me in this one. Because one of the bullet points is reduce the impact of climate-related disasters like wildfires, floods to make BC communities safer. Which, okay, great, but floodwaters don't obey acts of the legislature. That there actually needs to be some pretty important implementing details in there. And I have no idea what that promise actually means.
So overall, not a nothing platform. There are some highlights in here and some interesting ideas. Still, a lot of it is very vague, though. And a lot of it is just, we'll be the NDP light, or we'll build the same things plus this other thing. A lot of sections don't differentiate themselves that much. So there's a couple big promises off the top, like the PST thing and the ICBC changes, where they would go different, clearly different. But a lot of other areas where, honestly, they just want to run a government that's not too different from what the NDP have promised. Weirdly.
Yeah, outside of the PST thing and the ICBC bringing in private insurance, there's actually very little here that is distinctly BC Liberal in a lot of ways. And I think that goes through the broader problem they've had figuring out what it means to be a BC Liberal in the post-Clark, post-government years. That combined with an overall, I think, lack of focus and not a particularly well-run campaign, that the PST thing should be doing more to pull out like parts of here and actually make it a major part of their platform and stuff. So like, I'm looking through their fiscal stuff at the back of the platform here. They're promising $1.3 billion in additional health spending. Like, we know some of that's going to be going to the long-term care homes, but that's a sizable chunk of money that doesn't really, that they're not super clear on actually where that's going and what that means for people in the ridings they're trying to win. Same thing with the $1 billion they want to spend on education, or the $1 billion on housing in here. Housing and other commitments, they call it. You know, $8 billion should have a lot more kind of oomph to it if you're actually going to be throwing that much money around. And so overall, there's a distinct lack of oomph in this platform outside of maybe the PST.
Well, from restoring confidence and rebuilding BC to the BC Greens plan for a more equitable and sustainable BC, which is quite the mouthful of a title.
Yeah,
but it has name in the title.
We dunked on the Liberals one a bit at the start, but this actually, I think, may be the worst title of the two, just because it is such a mouthful and doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
We could just call it a more equitable and sustainable BC, and that is a bit more clear. What I'll give the Greens credit for in their platform is having a table of contents. That's something the Liberals skipped. The Greens also have no pictures in theirs. The NDP was a bit heavy on pictures. If you like text, the Green platform is definitely for you. But let's go through it. It's also, I think it's promising the most spending other than the Liberals' infrastructure, if you set that aside, the most structural spending, something like $4 billion in the first year and then $10 billion spent over the first 3 years of a Green majority government, if they win that. They start off with education and childcare as well. They talk about ending the, quote, age of scarcity in education, permanent boost to funding for remote education, mental health, nutrition, basically an additional $500 million in the first year. It still lacks a bit of specificity in how they'll fix education in their view, but it's an attempt to be very pro-public education, at least.
Yeah, the Green Party, in a lot of ways, has similar problems to the Liberals, with some of the policies get pretty vague once you get past the headline on it.
I think we talked about that in a couple of the early announcements, like their childcare one, I think we talked about earlier. But just to recap, they want to go beyond what the NDP would and just essentially provide free childcare for kids who are under three and put kids who are 3 to 4 with working parents into preschools with a $300 million budget for the bump for the education system. If you're a stay-at-home parent, they haven't forgotten about you. They'd give you $500 a month, essentially, to look after your own kid. All of which is a very ambitious plan. And I think one of the challenges the NDP have had is expanding childcare as fast as they want to is expensive. The reason they didn't do it in 2 or 3 years is they looked at what happened in Quebec and went, oh, there suddenly aren't enough people to look after all these kids. So we need to take our time, train people up, take existing care, childcare systems, bring them into a more regulated system and build it out slowly. I think there is room for more ambition in here, and I like to see the Greens pushing on that. I'm super biased in that I'll take either $500 a month or fully covered childcare for my kid. Relating to childcare and flexible working arrangements is the promise and discussion around 4-day a work week, which the Greens and Sonia Firstenau specifically have had a lot of airtime taken up by. She got in a very famous spat with former leader Andrew Weaver about a 4-day a work week. And so it was actually surprising for me to see in their platform that the actual commitment is that they would consult with business, labor, and other stakeholders to explore options for reduced work weeks and flexible work hours. For example, encouraging employers to adopt a 4-day work week. And I think I've heard Firstenau quoted several times saying she would not introduce legislation to change the labor code to this end. And for a lot of workers, it's not actually easy to go down to 4 days unless it's going to be mandated. Like, teachers aren't going to go to 4 days suddenly.
Well, it's going to be hard for a lot of places to go down to 4 days, which is why it's probably a good thing to not just come in and start drastically changing the labor code without first going through the hard work of figuring out all the impacts that would have. So in that sense, I'm glad to see them showing some restraint here. On the other hand, it's not exactly we promised to consult on this and maybe start to move in that general direction. Isn't exactly the rallying cry that gets ballots and boxes.
It's not even eventually move in that direction. It's we're going to consult on this and then say, people should do it, maybe, if you can. But if you can't, don't worry about it. There's a number of areas in here where the Greens have their childcare thing was very ambitious, but then other things are very modest in some ways. The next section of their platform is income security, and here's where they talk about wanting to start to move towards a basic income for everyone. The way they would get there is starting with a basic income for youth aging out of care, and they would also make the $300 crisis support that was given for people on income assistance, make that additional money permanent and index further assistance payments to inflation, which are all good things. Kids aging out of care is a huge issue, and giving them basic income seems like a really good first step. I imagine a lot of the work on basic income will have to wait for the task force report.
Yeah, it almost certainly will. Yeah, the index to inflation thing is something that's really good to see. And once again, you got to wonder why that isn't already the case. Very few permanent programs that transfer any sort of amount of money based on any sort of criteria. Really, there's no reason not to have them indexed to inflation if it's more than a one-year program.
The thing they don't want to just index to inflation, though, is the minimum wage. That's something I think the NDP would promise to do once we hit $15, or we hit $15. But the Greens would create an independent fair wages commission to recommend minimum wage increases as necessary. And it's not clear to me why they wouldn't just index it to inflation unless the fair wage commission reviewed and said, we're not going fast enough. We need another big step up. But they're trying to take politics out of it in some way, which fair enough. But I'm confused why this requires a commission.
Yeah, it really does seem like one of those things that once you get it at roughly the right level, you can probably run it on autopilot with an inflation indexing or probably another good 10 years or so before really having to do a big another look at it. So yeah, I don't get why you'd want like a permanent commission that'll be tweaking it every year or so based on who knows what inputs.
The Greens next have a section on housing affordability. A lot less detail in here than the Liberal plan that we covered earlier. This would really just try to do a housing first approach to, quote, affordable supportive housing. They're big on co-ops, unsurprisingly. They want to work with local governments on missing middle housing, like townhomes they talk about. And they would establish a capital fund to buy and maintain nonprofit rental housing.
So with the work with local governments to expand missing middle housing, I really want to know what's actually in there, because there is nothing that stops local governments that want missing middle housing from doing missing middle housing. It is entirely a case that the reason there isn't missing middle housing in most places is because the local governments do not want it. Because the most vocal people in those local areas do not want it. So unless the Greens want to have a somewhat heavy hand from the provincial government to do a lot more than just work with and take some either hefty incentives or outright requirements by law, there isn't actually much that I can see moving with this.
They also, in terms of areas where they don't go as far as the NDP, and we talked about this before, would introduce a means-tested rental supplement to help people who are paying more than 30% of their income on rent get down to that. It's as vague in the platform as it was when we talked about it from the announcement earlier. And it really just feels like a way of being like, we'll have a renter's rebate, but it's totally not the same thing the NDP are doing because we don't agree with that one. And helping renters, I think, is a worthwhile effort, but it's just not clear to me what's happening here.
Yeah. So the two big arguments that I see in favor of a rental rebate, rental supplement, whatever you want to call it, is to provide fairness to the fact that we have a homeowner's grant, which is a stupid policy that should never have been implemented. But basically anyone with a house worth up to, what is it, 1.7 million, 1.65, something like that, just gets a check from the government. But renters get nothing. So since nobody actually wants to take away that money, you might as well do a match for renters. Now, whatever the equivalent for a renter of owning a $1.7 million house is probably going to be a lot more than what the Greens are proposing here. So that could be improved upon. And the other big benefit, and this is something that I know Lindsay Tedds has been quite vocal about, is the fact that it's really useful for tax enforcement and tax data collection. Because if you have the renter supplying their place of residence and requesting a rebate from the government or a grant from the government, well, you can cross-reference that with the people who own the property and see if they're actually declaring the income of their rental property. So in that sense, it's definitely more revenue positive than initially seems, because you can tackle a lot of small-time landlord tax evasion.
Another area the Greens go as...
Yeah. Which, when you're introducing like an income or a means-tested thing like that, and you're going to have a much more spotty data set of people applying for it, it does reduce the benefits there significantly.
Another area the Greens don't seem to go as far as the NDP is, the NDP notably endorsed the Access BC pledge to make contraceptives free for everyone through MSP, and this is what led Lori Thronis to ultimately be kicked out of caucus. But the Greens want to only make it free for those under 25 and then remove the PST for everyone over 25, which is like a halfway to the point of it. And I see the value of definitely having free contraceptives for children and or free contraceptives for youth and young adults. But is the marginal cost like worth it to cut it off at 25?
Once again, it's one of those things where it's really going to depend on what the administration of the setup is, but I can't imagine the savings are that big to really necessitate basically two different subsidy systems for contraceptives operating concurrently.
Moving to the economic section, on small business and tourism, the Greens want to provide a $300 million for a six-month small business rent subsidy that would cover 25% of the rental costs for eligible businesses, and there's a bunch of criteria for who would get this and who wouldn't. This would be one of their key ways of supporting business through COVID, which seems like a reasonable program.
Yeah, all the
I wonder how hard it would be to administer, but we've rolled out quite a few programs.
Yeah, sorry. All the parties have some version of support for the tourism business. We breezed over it in the Liberal section because time restraints. But ultimately, I don't think there's too much of a difference between any of the parties on these ones. The details are, of course, different, but like they're all roughly trying to do the same thing and are probably going to be roughly as effective at it. So it seems like one of those things where you've got to have it in there, because if you don't, it becomes a problem. But I'd be surprised to see if this being... I would be surprised to see this being a vote move or a big way to differentiate any of the parties.
In the Vibrant Cities section, there's a lot of things you would expect from the Greens, but the two I want to talk about are how they would help cities essentially make more money. So one is to work with local governments to help them, quote, fully capture the public share of the land lift from transit-oriented development. And anyone who's followed the discussion in Vancouver, particularly from Councillor Christine Boyle in One City, know about the idea of a land value capture tax, where as cities rezone or increase the value through their development of local property, the city can use mechanisms to tax that and capture the increase in value that these other properties have because of policy changes by the city. And that can be used to help fund further transit expansion. It's a really neat model that doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah, there's a lot of benefits to adopting that. So I'm actually quite happy to see that in there, as along with a more general policy to reform the local government finance system and decrease the reliance on what they call regressive property taxes, but really aren't that regressive, because if you own property in Vancouver, pretty much by definition, you're wealthy. So
property taxes just aren't progressive. They don't scale with the value of the property.
Well, you factor in the school tax, they kind of do, but
They're slightly more progressive now than they were before, where it was just a flat tax.
Yeah, it's weird framing. That's not really true, but it's definitely a good thing that local governments would have more tools than just property taxes for revenues. So I would be happy to see, actually in general, I'd be happy to see a kind of big modernization of the municipalities and Vancouver Charter to give cities a lot more tools in that respect, maybe scaling back some of the ones they've been abusing on the housing front to make housing more expensive.
One of the tools that they would give cities potentially to fund transit expansion on their public transit section is mobility pricing. The idea that you should have to either toll roads or charge road users on a per kilometer basis for how much they're driving. We do this a little bit through gas taxes, but this could be a much better way to decentivize congestion and also just fund transit based on people who drive.
I am super happy to see this in here. In 2017, they were the only party to stake out the right position on bridge tolling. I'm happy to see they've tried to continue that with support for mobility pricing here. It's one of those things that tends not to be politically popular, but or at least when it's first proposed, but works really well. And the cities that have adopted it, it's actually been a big success. Places like Stockholm, London, and Singapore all have various congestion pricing systems, which were not popular when they were introduced, but have in turn become quite popular because they are actually effective at reducing congestion, and you get a bunch of money that you can spend on various things like transit expansion or rebates or whatever. Yeah, really good to see it in here. And yeah, I don't have much hope that it actually come to pass because the Greens aren't likely to have enough political clout to force the issue, but it's good to see at least one party campaign on it. The other thing that jumped out at me on their transit section is they want to support the South Island transportation strategy thing. But they also want to create a kind of regional governance body for transit in the South Island, which sounds to me like they'd be getting kind of their own version of TransLink if the Greens win.
That could go very well or very terribly.
Yeah. And on just BC Ferries, they want to bring it back to basically renationalize BC Ferries.
Moving quickly so we can tie off this episode on the Indigenous reconciliation stuff, there's a lot of strong language. The one I want to pull out is that they want to move away from, quote, the colonial Ministry of Child and Family Development structure and really give Indigenous communities control over their own children who need to be put in care. First Now had some strong language during the debate that I don't think we touched on, where she referred to this as the new residential school system. And this has been highlighted by a number of reports that, well, it's not quite the 60s scoop, but it's a different version of still taking kids out of Indigenous families. And so the Greens have been strong on there and deserve props for that. Unsurprisingly, the Greens have lots to say on a green recovery from COVID-19. I still found their climate policies a bit underwhelming compared to what I was hoping to see. Their carbon targets are ambitious. They want to be carbon neutral by 2045 with interim targets for 2025 and 2030. But the specifics were a little bit lacking. They have things like get to 100% zero emission vehicle sales by 2035 instead of, I think the NDP said 2040. They'll put $1 billion into a green investment fund. They'll put $500 million into a fund for sustainable jobs and support a just transition for oil and gas workers. So it's a lot of the language we've seen from Green New Deal type things.
Yeah,
but aside from the take all the oil and gas subsidies away on day one and invest that in green innovation stuff, it's, I don't know, it doesn't reach the Seth Klein just war stuff I was hoping to see.
I agree. It is very vague. And yeah, I have a trouble seeing beyond the promise to end fossil fuel subsidies, which I think by law the Greens are required to have in all platforms.
We should have mentioned that I think the Liberals, it might not be specifically in their platform, but they've been talking about it this past few days, want to have a second major LNG plant just to one up the NDP, which is the opposite of where we should be going.
But yeah, as I was saying about the Green platform, it's, I don't have a really good sense beyond the draft is going to look different when you plot it all out, what exactly it means in terms of real on-the-ground policies. And yeah, like you said, it's vague and a little underwhelming.
On healthcare section, I think we've talked in the past about the Greens' position on long-term care. They want to be largely public as opposed to private and just have a shift in that, increase salaries, etc. They have a big commitment to mental health care that I actually really like in terms of $1 billion over 4 years to really bring mental health within the public system. On what they call the opioid crisis, they do want to scale up safe supply, enhance funding for harm reduction, decriminalize simple possession by following both Dr. Henry's plan to make some amendments to the Police Act, but also aggressively lobby the federal government to decriminalize it, whereas I think the NDP would only lobby. I want to highlight Sam Fenn on Twitter. He's the producer for the Crackdown podcast and someone who's been following overdose epidemic responses. He's got two Twitter threads critiquing the NDP and then the Greens platform on this. And he pointed out there, that was the first time I really thought about it, that the crisis isn't opioids, and framing it that way minimizes or distracts from the crisis is the fact that we have a toxic drug supply and people are dying from it. Opioids aren't necessarily a crisis. It's the misuse of them in some cases and the fact people are dying. So I'll link to both of those. And I think his critiques of both are pretty good. I don't think he's done one on the Liberals, but I don't think he'd be super keen on the send more cops into the downtown east side, but have a psych person with them. Finally, the Greens end with a section on managing our natural assets. There's stuff in here about food security that I think we've talked about a little bit in the past. They have a lot of stuff on forestry. They really want to protect old growth forests, and they've gotten a lot of credit for their language on that. They really want to, quote, take back control of forests from major corporations. They would give the government a bit more authority in decision making, do some reforms to tenure, and they would create the positions of forester general and chief scientist as kind of counterbalances to report to the legislature on how to manage our forests for the good of the province and local communities, but also the good of the environment. And they'd end raw log exports and make sure we're milling wood in BC, which is a longtime NDP position as well.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that never made a huge amount of sense, but seems to be, you know, one of those almost article of faith policies on the left side of the political spectrum in BC.
Some of the other natural assets is, in terms of protecting water, they'd ban fracking entirely in BC. There'd be a watershed security fund. There'd be $100 million over 4 years for climate adaptation initiatives. And one thing I thought was interesting is they'd move the Fish and Wildlife branch from the Ministry of Forest, Land, Natural Resources, Operations, and Rural Development. They'd have Fish and Wildlife duties now be a subset of the Ministry of Environment. And I think that reflects a kind of view that fish and wildlife are part of our environment rather than a resource to be used. I don't know what that would mean on the day-to-day, but that kind of reflection fits with the Greens, and I wouldn't be opposed to it.
They're both true when you think of it. So, but yeah, it definitely seems like a more Green Party way of looking at it. That $100 million for climate adaptation, once again, it is super vague. It's not clear at all what that actually means on that and what sort of adaptation policies they'd have. And like $100 million over 4 years, that just isn't a huge amount of money when you're talking about adaptation costs that are going to be in the tens of billions for the province over the long term.
Yeah, just fighting fires will eat that up quickly.
Yeah, I'm super confused on this. Is a Green Party that isn't exactly shy about promising new spending. So, like, why so little? The only thing I can think of is there's a sometimes reluctance among some environmentalists to talk much about adaptation because they see it as admitting defeat on the main mission. But there's no scenario that isn't going to require significant adaptation costs. Why isn't there more of it in here?
And finally, on this section, they would bring in an endangered species law and an environmental charter. And that latter bill would give you things like the right to clean air and clean water and things like that, which would be interesting. And I think it's been done in some jurisdictions around the world. What that would mean in courts would be, I don't know, I'd just be interested in seeing where that would go. Undoubtedly, it would be controversial.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds good.
Yeah. Like that's, I'm always very skeptical of those sorts of rights to clean air thing, because it's fine to say as in theory and have as like a guiding star when you're setting policy sort of thing. But the problem with drafting policy around rights is it gives you very little information on how to get to there. And also, inevitably, it ignores the fact that there may need to be some trade-offs when you have to deal with it. And it's a way of thinking about policy that is, I think, actively hostile to the having to think about the trade-offs that are kind of inherent in any governance situation. But yeah, on the clean air thing, it's actually interesting how little air pollution gets mentioned when it's in this document. When like air pollution is a huge problem. I'll refer people back to the episode we did back in the spring, early summer on air pollution. Like it is a like multi-billion dollar problem in BC, yet basically doesn't get a mention outside of one sentence in the platform here.
The other things that didn't get a mention in the platform included ICBC, which has been quite the hot potato. as far as I can tell, the Greens are in favor of the direction the NDP is going and just don't want to mouth any opposition or a different vision for it, which is fair enough. It's within their right. But more surprisingly, they don't say anything about democratic reform or electoral reform, which we know has long been the position of the BC Greens. Undoubtedly, the defeat in the referendum has taken it off the table for most parties, but the Greens, if anyone, should be committed to PR.
Yeah, it's weird they don't even have anything in here at all about it. They don't even have really have much about improving how the legislature functions, I don't think, in here, which if you're not going to reform the electoral system, surely there's things the Greens would rather see change in the ledge to make it more democratic and accountable.
Everyone's just been so focused on the pandemic and specific day-to-day policies for people that we forgot about the higher level stuff. Like the closest we got to democratic reform policies was the BC Liberal will ban snap elections during emergencies promise. But overall, the Green platform's like a mix of greatest hits, some things that are to the left of the NDP, some things that seem like they're slightly more centrist just to be different than the NDP, and then just a lot of vague stuff that feels like they had to pull it together quickly, which undoubtedly they did.
Yeah, it in many ways was a lot less thorough. So I found the housing stuff pretty lackluster in here in a lot of ways, which we kind of touched on. But I actually pulled up with the old Greens 2017 platform, and just on like that one topic, it was a lot more detailed, kind of tackled the problem from multiple directions. And I think it's like one of the better platforms back in 2017 on that front. And I'm just using this as an example of what it's indicative of. But there's last time, I think they had a much more thorough platform that covered off things a lot better, and I'm just not really seeing it here. And part of it's going to be the snap election, but like the Greens are also better resourced now than they were 3 years ago. So I got to wonder why that's not showing up in the actual policy side of things.
There you have it. Our takes on the BC Liberal and BC Green platforms. I'm sure listeners, you have your own opinions. We'll throw links to the show notes. I encourage you to read them. And most importantly, I encourage you to go vote. Advance polls are open. Don't put a ballot in the mail because it may not get there by Saturday. So go vote somewhere in person, whether it's a district electoral office, an advance poll, or vote at your local polling station on Saturday. Stay safe.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.